Hello, and welcome to The Hump with Katie Thoreau. I'm your host, Katie Thoreau, and I'm bringing you interviews with some incredible artists, finding out why are they so amazing, how did it all happen, and what can we learn from their journey. Before we get started today, I would love to thank our sponsors. And first up, we have Jams World. Okay, you all know how much I absolutely love Jams World. It's a clothing company that's been family owned and operated in Honolulu, Hawaii since 1964. And they're offering our listeners a 15% online discount. And you guys, the reason why I love Jams World is because the clothing is made from 100% spun crushed rayon, and I run hot, and it keeps me nice and cool and comfortable. And the artwork is screen printed right onto the fabric. It's so unique. Go to jamsworld.com and use the promo code JAZZ15 and you'll get 15% off your entire purchase. That's jamsworld.com. Okay, next up, I would love to thank Kohlsteins. You guys, Kohlsteins is my favorite string shop in the entire world. They're based in Long Island, New York. They have two locations now and an amazing online store. They do everything from instrument repair, and they build instruments. They make their own strings and rosin. They pretty much do it all, and they're so knowledgeable there. If you go to Kohlstein.com and use the promo code KD10, you'll get 10% off your entire online purchase. That's Kohlstein.com. I'd like to remind you that I'm bringing you brand new episodes of The Hump every Wednesday, every hump day. So download and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and go follow us on Instagram at The Hump with Katie. You don't want to miss a beat of what's going on over here. I'm really excited to bring you our very first guest of 2021, and we are starting the year off strong. I have for you today virtuosic bass player Xavier Foley, and this was such a fun conversation and one of the perks of being in quarantine. I didn't know about him before, but I've been spending a lot more time on the internet, like you probably are, and I came across his virtuosic bass playing and his compositions. Just incredible. And then it turns out there's this whole background of his interest in business and how he brought that into music. So you're really going to enjoy this. He's really fun to talk to, fun to listen to, very fascinating. So without further ado, here is Xavier Foley. Okay, it's so great to meet you, Xavier. I only first learned about you earlier this year because of COVID and because of the internet, you know. Everyone's always like, of course COVID's terrible, but I've met so many people from just like being on the internet. Some of it is just like, you know, YouTubing, like how to learn how to do stuff, but then just like finding amazing musicians like yourself. So it's been really fun.
Yeah, same. Yeah, the power of the internet. It's a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just kind of want to dig in, uncover maybe a couple layers of Xavier, because as I've been kind of learning about you and listening to you, you're so inspiring, because a lot of times people feel like if you're a musician, you're only a musician. And your creativity is only brought forth through your music. And you can't do anything else because you're a musician. And you're so much more than that. And I love that, because you have, you know, this business acumen, and you're doing all sorts of like new things right now. But I love it because it's really inspiring. You don't just have to do, you know, one single thing in life. So
sure, yeah.
So I just kind of want to get in there. And you're just an amazing musician. It's really fun to watch you, and I want to talk about something you said earlier this year on one of your blogs. But do you mind if we just start at the beginning?
So as like how I started bass?
Yeah, I'm always curious about people's origin stories, because for me, people, it's usually they start bass because someone like in band that was like the last instrument left, or they just saw it and they fell in love with it. So how did you come to play bass?
Yeah. So my story is, I started in middle school, and, I wanted to be a percussionist when I, that was my dream. So I went to tryouts for, the percussion, and I apparently failed the test to be a percussionist.
How do you fail a test to be a percussionist?
I'm still trying to figure it out myself, but,
because that's usually where they put, like, you know, the ones who can barely, you know, clap their hands together.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I played piano before. I did the xylophone thing. Yeah. Pretty good. And I think I had rhythm. Mm-hmm. So maybe they just didn't have any space left.
Yeah.
So, because percussion's a cool thing when you're in middle school. know, yeah. drumline, all that mm-hmm. kind of marching band. But so I went to the orchestra side, and there were no tests for double bass. And I was kind of happy about that. Also, I thought I would make more friends playing a giant instrument.
Oh, yeah, just that's a conversation piece.
Yeah, yeah, as an 11-year-old kid, that was something I thought would make me cool.
Yeah. So, were you right?
That was really it.
Were you right about the cool factor?
I don't know. It didn't work. I didn't make more friends. But everything else was pretty nice. You know, the music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you played piano before that and xylophone. So was that an easy transition for you to hop onto the bass? In terms of, like, you already, like, how proficient were you with piano?
Yeah, I played, you know, Bach conventions and Mozart and Bach and, like, Beethoven and stuff like that. So, yeah, when I started when I was 8 and, yeah, I mean, I was playing recital, like, just did a little mini recitals and stuff like that. But I didn't really like it because you had to do two hands at once. I wasn't a real big fan of that. And my mom also played piano, so she knew when I made a mistake, and that was kind of annoying too.
You know, my mom plays bass, and I had the same.
I feel okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was different for me.
She would sit in outside my lessons and take notes for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's funny. With bass, I didn't really have to worry about messing up.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really, my parents didn't really know. So I had more freedom to improv and stuff like that.
Nice. And it was one of those things when, after you got over the cool factor of the bass, was, were you like an incessant practicer, or did you have a teacher to start off, or was it just in your school orchestra?
I had a teacher pretty early. He was an Atlanta Symphony bassist, and they had these things called honor orchestra mm-hmm. where I was from in Georgia. So that's why I got the teacher to help me get in there. And that was like the first 6 months or something. And, you know, I thought this was pretty cool. The teacher, meaning Doug Summers is his name. We vibed very well. And that's when I started taking it seriously with the classical side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. I'm sometimes curious, but, like, were you practicing a lot as a kid, like hours and hours, or was it just kind of like, hey, let me pick this up?
Well, I did a lot of improv when I started, and I just liked playing around with the instrument, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when it came to stuff like classical music, because I would just play like jazz or something, or just play around anything, rock or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need to have a timer. So my parents had a little timer on the thing, but, you know, I guess once I started going into repertoire, like the Van Hall, no, not Van Hall, Vivaldi, cello sonata, I was like, wow, this music sounds really cool. Mm-hmm. Like the harmonies and stuff. So I really just, I naturally got into, just feeling it and expressing it. And that was, something that motivated me to just have fun with it. So,
was it hard for you to, because I love your arrangements and the compositions you come up with. So at that age, when you're kind of hearing this music, was it hard to stick with what was written? Like, would you kind of want to improvise at the same time, or were you able to just, okay, let me play this sonata or this concerto or something?
Yeah, when I was young, I didn't really do too much. Not too much, but yeah, because I was classical music was still something that was kind of new to me. I was so used to playing, listening to like jazz and rock and hip hop and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I would improv that kind of stuff.
Okay.
With classical music, not so much.
But I'm just imagining you as a kid, like, you know, rock jamming out on something. And that's like a written piece of music, but improvising it as well.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'd put a twist to it, some kind of, but yeah. I mean, I wasn't that kind of person who would be like, oh, I'm going to make my own cadenzas now at age 15 or 14. I wasn't really doing too much of that. So
that's cool. You had other musical influences, because that's, again, I keep talking about now, but like the things you write and arrange have everything, you know, you're not just in one you know, I'm only playing classical. I love it because you hear folk, jazz, gospel. You kind of hear a little bit of everything. So you were listening to all sorts of other music other than classical. And I'm curious, was around that age, like when you were in middle school and high school, did you have another like another group of kids your age that were into the music that you guys can kind of like talk about it, or were you just kind of focusing on your music?
Yeah, so I was in the Youth Symphony in Atlanta, and everybody there was pretty serious, and a lot of the kids there went to music school. Mm-hmm. So, and some of them I was classmates with too. So at a conservatory. So yeah, it was an opportunity to chat with other musicians. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes it could be kind of now different since we're in COVID and everyone's on the internet, but it can be very, very intense at that age where people, I remember growing up and they're like, you know, they'll be in your face. Like I practiced 8 hours today and, you know, I learned this and I got this far in this concerto. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm still a kid. I'm going to listen to the music I want to listen to and maybe, you know, go play some baseball or something.
Yeah. Yeah. You hear that a lot about the people. So they call it in this generation flexing. I don't see the point. I feel comfortable just doing what I'm doing. And as far as practice time, I wouldn't do too much because at a certain point you just lose the creativity and you just mm-hmm. repeat the same thing over and over and nothing really happens. So. Yeah. I guess what I really enjoyed was, the creative aspect that was really important to me. And, like seeing what cool things I could do with the music, like, mm-hmm. you know, I guess, for example, like one of my favorites is the Arpeggioni Sonata. And, that's funny because, as I mentioned, I got a complaint on one of my YouTube videos about it sounding kind of jazzy, which is interesting. But what I enjoy is making connections with like real life stuff. Like if it's a sliding down motion, I'll try to make it sound like you can feel the slide. You know, mm-hmm. like in yeah, yeah, da 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 da.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I want the listener to be, and I really like that kind of thing. But I can only do a certain amount of that at each day. You know, I can't do that kind of creative stuff 8 hours.
Yeah. And then sometimes there's an aspect of just, okay, I'm going to do something in the moment, even though I may have practiced it this way, but I'm in front of this audience and I feel this way today.
Yeah, that too. A lot of times I chase my boys and fingerings and change strings. Once you know the piece, you really know it, and that's the way I look at it. Then you're good to go. Just enjoy.
Yeah.
And, of course, you're going to probably make a mistake here and there in a live performance, and just gotta expect it to happen. I mean,
there's gonna be one nerd out there that's gonna go wrong.
Yeah, I get a lot of that. I'm telling you, like a lot of sometimes, like it's the hardcore bass players, that try to just look at your bow grip and your fingers, and it is what it is. Like whatever makes you happy, you know, pointing out other people's stuff.
Yeah,
whatever.
But that's one of the you know, sometimes people. I mean, I'm a jazz musician, and so they think like, oh, jazz, you're improvising all the time, and you don't do that in classical music. Like, you know, expression is only for jazz music. But it's, in my opinion, that's totally not true, because like you're saying, you could play a piece of written music, you express it a certain way. And I'm not going to go into who my favorite conductors are of certain symphonies, but someone will put on a record, and I'm like, this isn't how I like it to sound. I like it when this other guy conducts it.
Right.
So it's amazing that even though it's written down, it's like someone else, like you're saying, they put their own life, their own experience, their own you know, that moment in time into it. And it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I can see how it it kind of hurts for some people to see someone doing something different than they are.
Yeah,
it's kind of a threat. It's kind of a threat to their own ego, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is whatever. You know, when people play my music, you know, people play all sorts of ways. They cut out bars sometimes or add stuff. It's you know, the whole point is to have fun and evoke that feeling. You know, that's what I really think. And I enjoy other, I mean, and I'm totally comfortable with it. I mean, some of the stuff is really, really different. Like I didn't write that, but it is what it is. Like, and I just, if you pull it off really well, I enjoy it. So
yeah, that's a good attitude to have. Cause it's like, you could hold on to it. It's like, this is my precious thing that I did. And you have to do it exactly like that. But life isn't like that.
No. It's yeah.
So while you were in high school, did you, you entered into some competitions in high school, right?
Yeah, I did.
So what is that like? Cause again, on my side of like being a jazz musician, it's so weird because, I don't know, someone could solo on something and then someone thinks the other one's better, but someone thinks the other solo is better. It's all the same chord changes, whatever. So it's a little weird to judge, but I also think also in classical music. So how was that for you as a, you know, teenager preparing for these competitions? And were you like, did you have that like winner's attitude? I have to win? Or was it something like, this is fun. I'm just going to try my best.
Yeah. The way I saw it was a challenge for me to present a piece that's to the best of my ability. And I think competitions really helped me because when I first started competing, I didn't really win that much, but I saw other performers who were very serious and like brought something to the table that was a very good product. And that always inspired me. And I always thought to myself, man, I wish I could do something like that. And and then I guess I cultivated this attitude of, if I'm going to play something, it has to be really ready and I have to make a statement, which is what the competitions and being at Curtis too, it's a very competitive environment. I'm probably jumping the gun here, but a school like that, everybody is doing competitions, competing, and you see all these great people your age or some younger, and it's like, okay, so this is the standard. So you kind of raise the bar a bit, but I wasn't really out there to, you know, out for blood or to, like just knocking people off.
Yeah.
That wasn't the whole point. It was to learn the ability to create a very solid musical product to present on stage.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And it doesn't, for the most part, you know, some people, they put tons of money into like, you know, making a record or a CD or something. And this is like essentially free. I mean, you have years of training, but it's just kind of like you're taking on this own project. It's a really great way of looking at it.
Sure, yeah.
I had my next question in mind. Well, so you ended up going to Curtis. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that experience too, because I know it's intense. Oh, I know what I was going to ask. Even at that time, like when you're in high school, did you have this career trajectory in your mind? Like, I want to do this, or you were just kind of like, these things are coming my way, so let me do them. Or did you have this idea of like, I want to be a solo bassist or I want to play in a symphony, or did you have any idea of what you wanted to accomplish?
You know, at the time, my high school mentality was, a bit different. I didn't want to be a soloist, and that was it, you know, because a lot of people, a lot of peers, like, and they're like, you got to be the best of the best and all this kind of stuff. And that's what people talk about is like, oh, I want to be like Yo-Yo Ma or Josh Bell, or It's a Pro Man. Like, they're the best of the best and all that kind of stuff. So I was like, all right, so I guess I'll just try to do that, whatever that means. And, And I don't really know where that was going to take me. It was more of an image kind of thing. So as far as career, which is usually about, you know, what kind of job you will have that will really make an impact on society. I didn't really think that way until college. And once I graduated and in the real world just kind of hit my face, and then that's when things changed. So no, I didn't really know what I wanted to do.
It's funny because college itself is somewhat, if you're at a place like Curtis or other, you know, real conservatory or institutes, it's its own little incubator, right? Because you have these amazing experiences, you have incredible teachers that other people don't have the opportunity. So it's like this little like closed, safe society. I mean, you're all like battling each other, you know, in the practice rooms and all that. But it's very not real world in that sense where not everyone's going to have that opportunity to, you know, have these master classes and people coming in. So yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit about Curtis, and that's also. So, is that where you wanted to go?
Absolutely. 100%. And that's the only school I auditioned
Nice. I love those stories.
to.
And you did you go there because you wanted to study with that certain teacher? Was it the atmosphere?
So I knew Hal Harold Robinson. He's the principal of the Philadelphia Orchestra. I knew him before Curtis. I went to Curtis and he's a teacher there. And I did something called Wabase Institute, which is in Indiana. Wabase, if that's a place, I think it's Wabase, Indiana. And Renan Meyer was teaching there along with Hal Robinson and I think Eric Larson. So I got to know him really well in the atmosphere. I also got to meet Rex Serenay, who was also a student at Curtis, and I think he's with the Metropolitan Opera now. Fortunately, they're not open, but it's so I got to know players well, and also Edgar Meyer, who's a soloist and composer, also teaches there occasionally, not all the time. But I was a big fan of Edgar's approach to music and his creativity, and so. That was I really wanted to go to school like that, where it's you know, Hal's a really caring and relaxed teacher, and very big on excerpts, which is, you know, I was curious about that too. It's like, you know, maybe I want to get an orchestra job or something. But yeah, and so that's why I really wanted to go. And they all it was I got the impression that Curtis was a really high level institution, and I saw that as a challenge. There was one spot to get in,
I was going to
so I was
ask,
like, oh wow, okay. But being used to the competitions and stuff, I was kind of like, that's kind of how it is. The spot, you either do your best or, you know. So I spent a lot of time preparing, and I think something that helped was the International Society of Bassists competition. I did that right before, and so preparing for something like that, and then doing Curtis kind of helped because I had that performance experience. I just so happened to get in, and I was very happy about that.
And there's probably, I don't know, just a handful of bassists in the studio, right?
Yeah, there was seven at the time when I was there.
Nice. Yeah, that's slim pickings there.
Slim pickings.
So just like, you know, in a nutshell, what was your experience like there? Did you do 4 years?
Five, because I was in there 1 year early because I didn't finish high school yet. So I had to do high school and college at the same time the first year. But then
You know, I had a feeling, Xavier, I was going to ask you, like, because I noticed that you speak quite a few languages, and I was going to ask you if you excelled in, you know, the liberal arts subjects as well.
I wasn't really a like a super math guy. I studied in the past, but I'm not really a double degree kind of. I wouldn't do a double degree if I could.
Okay.
I definitely focus a lot on music. Now after college, that changed, and I did delve into different subjects. But at the time, I was really music focused.
Okay.
Yes.
So at Curtis, you had the experience, I'm sure, to play in an orchestra.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
How was that? Was it different? Like a completely different experience from, you know, coming from Atlanta, I mean, Georgia,
playing. Yeah, Atlanta Symphony. Yeah.
Okay.
The youth orchestra there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very different. I remember the first rehearsal after orientation, I showed up right on time.
Oh.
I think it was 4 p.m. rehearsal. I showed up. I was the last person there, and I got chewed out by the dean.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
This is some serious stuff here.
That's the on time is late.
On time is late.
Yeah.
It is late. Yeah. What they say is true. It'd be early is on time. And then, I got a lot of advice, or should I say criticism about, you know, how I operate in the section.
Mm.
And, you know, looking at this principal player and their bow and coming in, and I got a lot of information.
Okay.
The hard way.
Yeah.
So I really knew that this is a serious thing and I really need to step it up. So that's kind of what it's like. And everybody who plays in the symphony, very serious. The music making is good. I mean, that's something I noticed.
Yeah. That helps.
Understatement for sure. But yeah, so.
Oh, that's fantastic. Did you guys travel at all at Curtis?
I went to one tour, which was the Dresden, Germany tour. That was really cool.
That's awesome. Did you guys get to mingle with other orchestras?
No, but we did collaborate with a dance company with the West Side Story.
Oh, very cool.
That was really cool, yeah.
Nice. Okay, so Curtis was great for you. We can wrap that up. So I'm not sure how great my timeline is after that. And was it at Curtis that you were continuing to do more competitions like Sphinx and things like that? Or was that afterwards?
So, yes, a lot of competitions happened during Curtis. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what's the dynamic? Because I'm sure other bass players are doing, like your friends are all doing the same. You guys are all going for the same stuff, right?
Yeah. A lot of competing for, and some of the players would do orchestra auditions too, like New York Phil when they're a sophomore. And it was pretty serious. And, but it was great. I mean, it's a great experience. And, you know, sometimes people will win, like the Met job. I think Teddy was a bass player there, won the Met, and he was at Curtis during the time. And Rex too, and a lot of other people doing pretty well. So it's not like an environment where it's like, okay, I do my 4 years and then I'm out. It's like, okay, because you're seeing all the people getting these like Queen Elizabeth competitions and like big things like so early. So it's like, okay, it's this school, but it's a serious, like, I guess I should start doing a lot of serious things now, like orchestra jobs and very big competitions. So.
But did you want to do those things or was it because you saw other people?
Well, so I never did an orchestra job audition because I knew that I wanted to do something more free and creative.
Mm-hmm.
And orchestra's great if you love it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of energy. I knew that if I did do orchestra, I wouldn't have the energy to dedicate to it as compared to a serious orchestral musician.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I notice when I leave the Curtis Symphony and do other things, I compose and practice a lot of solo rep, I would go to orchestra, but I wouldn't be there 100%.
Yeah.
You know, because my creative juices were, got to be creative in orchestra, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just being in tune with the section and the conductor, that takes a lot of brain power for 3 hours straight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's something, that's the big reason why I thought it would be the right thing to do for the section's sake. You probably want to have someone who's very serious. I mean, I know other players who do the double thing. They come play but that from my experience, I want to be 100% with the creative in whatever I do.
Well, yeah, that's really considerate of you.
Considerate. Yeah. That's the word to say. Yeah.
No, and it's the same thing. I mean, in my profession, you know, someone might have a career like a day job and then they play gigs at night. And you're playing with them and it's kind of like you're phoning it in. I please play like 100% right now. And it gets frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can work. I guess it can, but for me, it don't work like that. I have to, you know,
well, it's good. You know yourself well enough to have already figured that out.
For example, if let's take a neurosurgeon who's about to operate on somebody's brain. That's a very serious thing.
Yeah.
It's a pretty dramatic comparison, but it could be, you know, I would take it as seriously as operating on someone's brain. If you're spending like 6 hours beforehand doing something like construction, and you know, you just almost built the house, and then okay, now I'm going to operate on somebody's brain, but I'm really tired.
Yeah,
don't want that person doing that.
No, definitely not the construction or the operation.
Yeah. Someone's livelihood, someone's living there. Yeah. Your roof's going to, you know, you gotta pay attention. You gotta be 100% there.
But I think about that too. Even if you're just, you know, if you're focused on doing one thing, sometimes people, it can get kind of frustrating. Like you're on tour and someone's like, oh, I'm really tired today. And it's just kind of like, no, people paid money to come see us. They had to get a babysitter. This is their night out. I'm paying you, like, well, money aside, but it's like, it's 2 hours. Let's just, you know, just be here right now.
Yeah. 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 That's a very good one. Sometimes I make the mistake of doing too much, you know, trying to set up an account for like healthcare or something. And then I have rehearsal and like, gosh, I was on hold for an hour and then I dealt with this really annoying person. I'm just sorry, guys. I can't play Prokofiev today.
Yeah, sorry.
It's a thing. Like it, you can tell I can tell when I'm not there. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of ghosting it.
Yeah,
just kind of hoping time will go by.
Yeah,
I don't want that. So
no,
yeah,
it doesn't feel good. No.
Yeah.
So when did you get into like really composing music, and did you study that at Curtis, or was that something you kind of discovered on your own?
So the music thing, I did study a little bit, but I studied with a classical composer, and there's kind of this, I don't know, maybe it's this kind of expectation of composing classical music. You got to do the A rhythmic bars and kind of mix and match the atonal, all this. And I wasn't really, that's something I didn't really want to focus on because the music I wanted to express was a little diverse in a way. So my first tune that I wrote out of all the other ones before that didn't really work out was the Irish Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a folk song I turned into a double bass virtuosic kind of piece. And that was really something I wanted to capitalize on because, one, I really enjoyed that kind of music. I really liked working with folk tunes like that. And it was something I had experience with because I played a game a really long time ago that had that soundtrack.
Mm.
And I kept listening to that for hours and hours and hours while playing this game. While I was, I think it was 11 or something. And then it's something like I really enjoyed just working on.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing more of that. So I'd take a tune, like I wrote this tune called Cranberry Juice, which is influenced by is it country? I don't know. It's acoustic something, Nashville okay. something. And it's got that dun dun. It's got that rhythm and blues kind
okay.
of feel to
okay,
it.
Yeah.
And that's something I enjoyed. I put a little twist to it, but I'm like, all right, this is great. I'm just going to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm. and I'm just curious. Do you write? Do you write by hand? Do you use the computer? Are you figuring it out on the bass first and then tweaking it?
So bass solos, I do. I play it out first.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. So I record sound bites and I put them together, and then I'll write it down once I'm finished. But that's only for solo music. For multi instrumentals, I use Sibelius.
Mm-hmm.
It's a computer program.
Nice. That was just my nerdy question.
No, it's important. Got to know what people are using.
Exactly. So I know I started off our conversation saying, I love that you're not I feel like you don't pigeonhole yourself. Cause again, people are just like, oh, you're a musician. So you're only creative in that one musical aspect. And you've written a book. Are you making bows or?
No, I don't. I partnered with somebody and I just put the logo on.
Hey, there you go. Got to sell the merch. no, but I love, cause I read a blog post of yours earlier this year about, being audience centric as well. So I like that there's a lot of creativity in business, right? Like the most successful, business people are very creative minds. And so like creativity isn't just for the arts, right? You can, see that everywhere in life. So how is, I know you've studied some business just on your own, right?
Yeah.
So how has that helped you studying those certain, you know, the creativity of business?
So it all started when I was writing music in Philadelphia, and the way it would work before COVID was I would visit various coffee shops, but then I'm like, okay, maybe I could go to these free areas and like in the Comcast, what do you call it? The kind of building, a corporate. I would go to these corporate centers where they have food courts downstairs. And I would hear conversations with these big CEOs. I never saw these people before, but I guess I was at the right place at the right time at the food court in the corporate center. So you see like the CEO of Comcast, you know, just getting some Panda Express and you're sitting next to him and the VP of the person who built the building next door.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I as a musician, I don't really mingle with these kind of people. So I'm listening in and they're talking about these big projects and this big product that they're working on that has innovative qualities and differentiation in the market. And I'm like, I don't understand what you guys are saying, but I really want to know. So I start buying these books. The first book I bought was Supply Chain Management.
Mm.
I was like, okay. Because I was like, I always wonder, like, how do they take a raw piece of material and turn it into a product?
Yeah.
I never really understood that. So I'm like, okay, you work with this supplier, you take it to this distribution, and then you learn about the costs of transporting something versus renting, like
you learn the true cost of what something from start to finish is.
Yeah, and then the overhead cost, and then the actual retail price, and like how that works.
Mm-hmm.
It opened my mind to like how stuff, like when you buy something on a shelf, you really truly understand where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And And then you start. Yeah, and then you really get smart about it. So, okay, so I go to Walmart, then I go to Home Depot, and then you see these two same products, and they come from the same distributor in Yangjing, China. Mm-hmm. And they're really, all they're doing is retailing it, but the brand is what's important, and the marketing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I learned about that, and then I started building these non-related music ventures.
Okay.
So, my first thing was my little side business was selling travel pillows.
Oh, did you do that thing where you buy like 10,000 pillows and then you like then you sell them on Amazon?
No, I think that's Amazon FBA. That's another big thing. I've never really gotten to that. What I did was drop shipping.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So that didn't work out because you got to really. First of all, everybody's kind of trying to do that and they don't really know what they're doing. And I was one of them. So that's another thing that kind of motivated me to do some more research into how this kind of stuff works. So I failed that. I lost a lot of money on that advertising, Facebook ads, Google ads, all that kind of stuff.
But you learned a lot.
Yeah, I learned a lot for the price.
Yeah.
I guess the price, I paid the price for sure.
But you didn't have to go to business school to learn to pay that, so.
Yeah, I guess you go to business school, you learn from the books, or you learn from the field.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess it is whatever.
You're still playing right now, right? While you're doing these other things?
Yeah, I'm still playing, for sure. Okay. So I'm not as serious as I was. You don't even have to be as serious as you.
No, no.
That you don't have. So I did waste a lot of time, but so yeah. And then I started getting the mobile apps. I started, I'd hire a programmer and then someone who does art design. Mm-hmm. And as my first app was called, it was some kind of cow game where you like shoot zombies or something. It didn't work out.
People didn't want to shoot cows?
No, it was a bad game, first of all. It was just a terrible game. And I thought, I didn't really know what I was doing. But I learned, how to not do everything myself. So hire someone that's better than you at something to do it. It's better, it's quicker, and it's better quality.
And even
so
though,
I would use these,
but like, even when you're like, I don't want to spend the money, but it's so worth it at the end because you didn't waste your time. You don't know exactly what you're doing. So to pay someone else who's an expert, it's amazing, right?
Yeah. It creates, and they get paid and then you get something and everybody's happy. So then after failing so many times, like I remember 2016 was the year I kind of started doing a lot of this stuff. And then 2017 came around. I'm still failing. 2018 came. I'm still screwing up big time. Now, then 2019, I kind of take a break. I kind of think things through for 6 months. Then I come back and then I play bass. Mm-hmm. Or no, XavierFoley.com. And then I play bass came. And so that was when I was like, okay, so I have this music thing going on. Why don't I combine the stuff I've learned with my own thing, which is the playing music and composing? Because I've never combined the two. Hmm. It was like, okay, let me do that and then see what happens. And then it's kind of working so far.
it's funny because that was probably, of course, like right in front of you the whole time, but you were kind of maybe pushing yourself to try these other completely different things.
Yeah, because I didn't want to make embarrassing mistakes in front of my audience that really knows me well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I found it felt more comfortable to do stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of like that. So
kind of incognito.
Yeah. I was in incognito mode. Then I went public.
Can you tell me a little bit about the book that you wrote and published?
Yeah. So, I wrote this children's book. It started as a blog post of a poem. I forgot. It's been so long, but it's about a little girl who is playing the lute. I should have had a bass. Yeah. I don't know why, but the lute, it's just the lutey lute lute. It sounded cool. It rolled off the tongue very well. So I was like, there was kind of this lesson I learned where I went through this phase of like, wow, is music really worth doing compared to this business stuff? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm hearing these CEOs talking about these $1 million deals and then making this big 5G blockchain, mm-hmm. all this weird stuff. but people take so seriously and like yeah. people pay yeah. big bucks for it. I'm like, is music really something that is valued in society? Mm-hmm. And I mean, so I write this poem and I'm thinking this, it's like, and this is kind of like raw feelings, like, okay. And then I'm like, so I write this poem and it's like, okay, this girl plays the lute and there's this blacksmith who represents the business part of society. The blacksmith creates these tools to build stuff, mm-hmm. like palpable
things that we need.
You know. and there's this artist playing a lute, and the blacksmith is like, "Can you not do that? I'm working here." That kind of thing. Like, can't you do something more important? And then the girl is like, "Oh, please, come on, man. You will soon learn your lesson that you really need this music." And then one day the blacksmith has a fish and the fish passes away. That was a really special fish to the blacksmith. Okay. And what happens is the blacksmith starts mourning and grief and sorrow and just feeling really bad. And the lute player catches wind of the blacksmith and she's like, "Can I play a tune for you?" Basically. And just like, "Oh, fine, go ahead." And when she finishes playing the tune, the blacksmith is like, "Ah, I feel so much better now. Mm-hmm. I can finally go back to work now." And it's kind of the moral of the story. It's art kind of helps move society and change mm-hmm. our emotions to where we're more able to be our best selves.
Yeah. And I bet even going, I think everyone who's an artist goes through that. It's like, well, I'm just going to go do computing. I'm just going to go somewhere and just like pick up phones or something. But I bet that would kind of helped you through whatever you were going through as well. Even if not everybody agrees, you know, about music's, you know, about the impact of music in our lives. But even those CEO people, I've been lucky to get to speak to some really amazing business people, and they're always just like, "I would do anything to be able to do what you do. I would quit my job if I could just do what you do." So my favorite minds always have that, it's that creativity back there, that but they really respect the music.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Yeah, awesome.
I hope you hear that too.
Yeah, I sometimes I get very bad vibes from some of these people. Like, they kind of are like, "Oh, yeah, I'll play bass. Come on, man. Come on, get a real job." You know, yeah. That kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I loved, I think it was from earlier this year, you one of your blog posts was about being more audience centric as opposed to, like pleasing your peers, you know, pleasing the people, the musicians around you who know about music. Did that change the way that you perform, that you put your sets together?
Yeah. So what inspired me to write that was, I bought this book called, customer research, something like that, where it's about providing a product that really solves a customer's problems.
Yeah.
And it was, so the mindset was not about creating something that was cool or you thought was like going to work and like going to make money and stuff like that, but creating something that someone actually really needs to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how can I apply this to music? Oh yeah. Why don't I write music with the idea in mind that someone's going to be listening to this. Someone's going to be sacrificing their own time. Mm-hmm. And they're probably going to be hoping to get entertained or some kind of deep meaning behind it or something like that. So, and playing too, playing wise, like rather than playing something on stage and not really having the audience in mind, that really opened my mind. So I'm like, okay, so let me write something and have the audience, like I'm writing something while being in the audience shoes. If so in measure five, you know, I'll write something where the violin is da 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 da, and then way over on the other side of the stage, the cellos, they'll repeat what the violin's doing, da 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 da. And so I'll be like, okay, so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get the audience to move this way. Mm. Then I want them to move this way. And then I want to combine the music together with the whole strings. And then, so what happened was like, I got them to move. Mm-hmm. And then I got them to be blown away by this big 2D of the same tune. So that's kind of like, I'm thinking about how can I make the audience, you know, really be engaged kind of thing, rather than just writing and be like, oh, okay, Darmstadt,
yeah,
12 tone. Yeah. Like that.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of why that's where that came from. Just thinking about who you're playing for.
That's amazing. Cause some of my favorite musicians and bass players, I mean, Ray Brown used to always say, play music that people want to hear. You know, you could play things for yourself, of course, and the people on stage with you, but like the audience, they're not going to connect to that. They're not going to remember it, and it's not going to make them feel better. And I know you've had those experiences where, like, after a performance, someone might say, like, that was the best thing I've ever seen. And maybe they're 80 years old, and you're like, really? You've lived a long time. Are you sure this is the best thing? But people have said that to you, right?
Yeah, so a funny thing is when I play a recital, I would, all the presenters are asking for mostly traditional.
Yeah.
And then maybe if I'll give you permission to put your own music. Yeah. That's kind of the mentality.
Yeah.
And there's truly nothing I can do about it. And I tried once and I got a phone call. It's like, you got to put some more traditional stuff, man. Mm. Even though there's not much traditional stuff for bass, do something.
Yeah.
Transpose.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I have to do. Right. But most of the time at the reception, they're like, yeah, the Franck violin sonata you played on bass was cool, but man, that cranberry juice.
Yeah.
Dang, man. What can I get a CD? Yeah. Almost every time they like, I really enjoyed your Irish or your Persian piece. That was really, I never heard something like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Bach, if I've heard.
Yeah.
I understand. It was cool, but man, that hair buster. Whoa. Like that. So I kind of wish, I don't know. It's a dream, but it's not really a dream because it depends on the presenter.
Yeah.
And so, but I really wish I could just play mostly my stuff and a little bit of traditional.
Well, yeah. The cool thing is like with, I'm just guessing like the audiences you're playing for, maybe they're primarily, you know, classical listeners. And so you're really broadening their horizons. You know, it's only helping.
No, yeah, they've heard Arpeggioni Sonata only a million times.
Yeah,
they, you know, so it's like, all right, but they really, even the classical music listeners, they really enjoy the different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they really talk about.
Yeah,
at the end of the performance. So,
well, cool, Xavier. I think I've peeled back enough layers. Well, I did also notice, like, you said you also got into meditation. I don't know if you still are meditating, but you said that also kind of helped. Realize like the audience, like their importance.
When did I say that?
In that same blog post.
I did. Oh, man. I did.
Sorry. Maybe you meditated on it.
Maybe, because I don't really meditate. I should, but
no, that's okay.
Maybe I thought about it.
Yeah.
I have to read it again. It was so long ago. But
no, that's okay. I won't even edit that out. I love this.
Oh yeah, this is great. Someone's going to correct me.
Yeah.
In the comments.
Well, this has been so much fun, Xavier. Is there anything coming up that you want to let us know about in the new year? I mean, I know who knows what's going to happen, but anything you're working on? Are you going to be drop shipping like cheese boards or? It's great for weddings.
Those days are over. Trust me.
Yeah.
I won't be drop shipping computer mouses anymore.
Woo! Or yeah, worse, mouse pads.
Yeah, actually, I do need a mouse pad. So if anybody's drop shipping that, I'll totally buy it from AliExpress for that discount price that you're selling it for retail for. I have this new space here. As you can see, it's very spacious. And I'm going to be trying to make a new recording studio.
Cool.
As you can probably tell, this room is very boomy.
Yeah.
So the idea is to get a bunch of acoustic panels. That spells out I Play Bass back there.
Nice. That's
pretty neat. And just record some more tunes. I have some more tunes coming up.
Oh, nice.
So that's really it.
Yeah, and we can go to iPlayBass.com or XavierFoley.com. And you've got all your music up there for sale.
Yep. Yeah, check it out.
Awesome. You got your bows, and I love your Instagram. You're on YouTube. And I'll put everything down anyways. All the awesome. Links and everything. But this is so cool. It's so awesome to meet you, Xavier. Thanks so much for taking the time. Happy New Year. And I look forward to hearing what you have coming out next.
Yeah, thanks for having me on here. It's been such a privilege and honor.
All right. Thanks, Xavier. Bye.
All right. Take care.